Tonight is our quarterly eating meeting and speaker meeting, and I'm going to ask Leo if you would mind introducing the speaker for us.
Now, Leo, you heard of us all.
Hey, Leo.
We have a special speaker tonight, John. John has 36 years of sobriety. I met John at the Marietta Roundup this summer, spring. And he was my roommate up at a men's mountain retreat this past June. We had a nice time up there. And he was telling me this is the only Friday night he did it from November to the Christmas that he's not playing Santa Claus. So, welcome, John.
Thank you, Leo. My name's Santa C. I'm an alcoholic. My name's John Cornelius. I'm an alcoholic. I'm like a lot of alcoholics. I've wanted all my life to be famous, and I finally made it under an assumed name. Just so typical of my life. Leo, I want to thank you for asking me to come here tonight. Leo was talking about the men's retreat that we went to earlier this year. It was up in the mountains of North Carolina, and it's a Al-Anon and AA men's retreat. And about half and half. And by the end of the weekend, it's very difficult to tell whether somebody's an alcoholic or an Al-Anon. Or me being an alcoholic, sometimes I'm standing there wishing, hey, I wish I could be one of them there Al-Anons and have a drunk wife and get her straightened around and wear butterflies and all that kind of stuff. But didn't work out that way. I born in 1938. Almost 3 years after AA got started. AA had a running head start, so they'd be ready for me when I got there. I was 30 and AA was 33 when I arrived on the scene. I joined Alcoholics Anonymous in dreary, eerie, the Mistake on the Lake, Pennsylvania. They have two seasons up there. It's 4th of July or winter. And you know, first time I heard about Georgia and got down here and got a look, I moved here. Mama didn't raise a fool. And I've been here coming up on 24 years now, and it's just still wonderful to be here, be around you. Once again, Leo, and I like eating meetings. When I was brand new in AA, guys like me were referred to as Belly AA. If we heard there was a meeting that they served food, I don't care how far away it was, we were there. And we also had the privilege of having Amish meetings. And when Amish meetings have an eating meeting, they, you know, from miles around, the Belly AAs show up because those Amish women can cook, and they believe that a pie should only be cut into four pieces. And they were thick pies. AA's been good to me. May 1st, 1968, the culmination of 30 years of failure. I had failed at literally everything. I failed at being a son. I failed at being a student. I failed at being a brother. You know, I failed at being a husband. I failed at being a father. I failed at being an employee. Boy, did I fail at that. There's lots of places back here. There's a couple down front here. I get paranoid with people behind me. But when I was drinking, I couldn't even have that door behind me, you know. I wanted to be where I could see who's coming in. I had I guess I was never what you would call normal. As my sponsor pointed out, my first sponsor pointed out to me, normal was a setting on the washing machine, and I was never going to be there. Another sponsor told me one time that normal was that place in the middle that as I swung from up to down, I would see it, just a little bit. That's normal. I'm not. I've just never quite fit in. I was always out of step. I was always, you know, they gave orders out before I got there. And everybody knew what to do, but I didn't. And I felt terrible. Plus, I was afraid. Thank God this happened back in the 30s and 40s, because Ritalin hadn't been invented. I think they would have I would have been the Ritalin kid, you know, because I had panic attacks and I was fearful. I couldn't talk out loud in the presence of any other, maybe one adult, if it was an old trusted adult that I knew, my parents, my brother, and a couple other close friends, but outside of that, no talking. I did not talk. I played with Mr. Nobody. I was sickly and had weird things, you know. Other kids get colds and stuff like that. I got polio, and I was in the polio hospital, and then they kicked me out of the polio hospital because they found I had tuberculosis, and I went into a TB hospital, and I was the only kid there for a while, and those adults remembered there was a kid with them for about 15 minutes, and then it was back to business as usual. And I got an education. Especially, you know, if you're quiet as a kid, you get to see everything. It's only when you start talking that the adults get worried about you. So I watched this whole panorama of life going on, and I took notes, you know. I'm going to try that someday. And other things that looked good to me. You know, we were all sitting there supposedly dying, and they were still smoking. It was a problem back then, too. I wanted to smoke. I had smoked once or twice. When I was 5 or 6 years old, my great aunt, I'd be sitting there, she'd be smoking her corn cob pipe, and a salesman or somebody had come to the door, she'd hand me the pipe, and I was supposed to sit there and look like I was smoking. She didn't want anybody thinking she smoked, you know. It was okay for a six-year-old kid. We had our priorities. I loved her. She was my favorite aunt. Anything I wanted, she got for me. She also called me her outlaw because I just was bad. Other kids would think, well, if I do this, I'm going to get in trouble. That thought process didn't go with me. I just did things. I continually did things. And I was known as that Cornelius kid. My brother was known as the other one. He was the good one. I was that one. I'm 66, almost 67 years old. I'm going to visit my hometown in a week or so. And I know that there were people that were going to say, there's that Cornelius kid, you know? Wonder what he's up to this time. And they based that on some pretty good information. My great uncle was a blaster. And I hung out with him. Boy, that was fun. I learned how to crimp dynamite, pour nitroglycerin in a torpedo and drop it down a well and frack it and come to one night, and we decided to get in trouble, and I had knowledge of not only where the dynamite was, but how to get it out, and how to cap it, and crimp it, and set it up for an explosion. And we dug a little hole in the dirt road near the park swimming pool, and cranked off a case of dynamite. Left a crater about 28 feet in diameter, 6-8 feet deep in the center. Barney Fife and the other cop came out. This was the days before seat belts. And they had them, you know, them Barney Fife hats on. And into the hole they went, stopped very quickly. Both of them dented the windshield. And most everybody knew it was me, but nobody knew for sure that it was me. But my uncle said, "I'm going to change the lock on the powder house." And fine, he'd get drunk and forget where he put the lock or the new key, and I'd find it, and no problem. Just trouble. But I couldn't talk. Very scared. Just totally withdrawn. Teachers tried to make me recite, and that was funny. They'd go, "You're going to recite." And they'd stand me up in front of the room and say, "You're going to stand here until you recite." Well, I didn't go along with that program, and it was very simple. I either threw up or peed my pants, or sometimes both. You do that, I guarantee you do that twice, the word goes out. Don't ask that Cornelius kid to do anything, because it's a mess to clean up and it smells bad all day, you know. And I made it through grade school and high school. I ran away. Well, I didn't really run away. I went with permission, but I didn't want to come back. When I was 14, I shipped as a cabin boy on a 66-foot ocean-going schooner, and came time to go back to school. I didn't want to go, and the captain said, "You can stay as far as he's concerned." Finally, the deputy sheriff and the truant officer came. I went back to school, but that was a liberating summer, because I could do something without adult complaint. You know, all I had to do was do my job, and it was wonderful. When I got home, I mean, everybody was always telling me what to do, and I lost all that freedom. 14 years old, back being a slave. I considered myself a slave. We lived on a farm, and if you live on a farm and you have a father that thinks you ought to, you know, do the chores, you're a slave. I didn't get paid for it. "We're feeding you and clothing you." I said, "Thanks." I could get downtown and beg better than I'm wearing. And my mother was a career woman. She was a newspaper woman, so nobody was doing the housework except my brother and I. You know, we didn't have a sister to flop it off on. So, you know, that's what women were supposed to do in those days. But my mother didn't, so my brother and I did. And we were housekeepers. And as soon as my brother got old enough, he escaped. He joined the Marine Corps. Left me with all the problems, you know. I resented that. I went on to college. I didn't really want to go to college, but I had scholarships, and my parents arranged for me to go to school. And I went to school. I was, let me just back for a second here. When I was in the polio hospital, my nurse therapist, didn't let me just lay in the whirlpool tank. She made me swim. She taught me how to swim, and it became very apparent to anybody that ever saw me swim that I was a natural swimmer. And by the time I was 11, I had two coaches, and I was being groomed for the Olympics, and I was just totally scared to death for it. And in fact, I started messing up training by smoking and other things in order not to get into that, because I knew I couldn't stand that kind of notoriety, and it just wouldn't work for me. But I did go to this small college. Let me explain that to you. There's a couple people here from the Pittsburgh area. They got smart too and moved down here.
Amen.
Grove City is a small town about halfway between Erie and Pittsburgh. And they should put a fence around it, sort of, you know, because it's a zoo. And that could be the new National Zoo, right, that little town in that area, because it was a small Christian college town. And it had a small Christian college in it. And I'm going to tell you something. Within months, they realized that I was a small Christian going to this, because I had found the fountain of youth. I had found the answer to every problem I ever had. My swimming coaches believed in better winning through chemistry. So when I was 9, 10, 11 years old, I was steady using Benzedrine, which is the precursor of all the good methamphetamines out there on the market today. I mean, I was doing this in the 40s. And I also, Benzedrine, some of you old folks remember this, came in an inhaler. And you take cap off, stick that sucker up your nose, go, and wow. You'd say to somebody, give me my buggy whip, I'm going bear hunting because of that. Well, they had me on that, and then they decided I wasn't big enough. I had this big head and this little skinny body, and they started me on anabolic steroids. So I bulked up, still am. You know, I'm blaming it on that now. Why not? God, wouldn't it be great to be a victim? Then you wouldn't have to take responsibility for everything. And anything. And here in Alcoholics Anonymous, they go, can't be a victim. You have to take responsibility. You have to own up to all this. You can't blame it on anybody. You can't blame your mother for, potty training you backwards or however. You can't blame anything on anybody. You have to stand there and say, my fault, I did it. It's like living a fourth and fifth and tenth step constantly. I am responsible. God, I... Sometimes you just like to go, it's his fault. It's her fault. But, and they look at you and go, I love AA. No matter where I step wrong, by gosh, somebody's there to tell me. Or worse yet, there's an Al-Anon that will come over and explain it. They start out by saying things like, well, now, you could be right, but... Oh my, I'm sort of wandering tonight, but I got kicked out of this college for drinking, and they suggested that I join the military, get straightened out, and come back. And to me, that wasn't a great idea, but it was the only idea that was being pushed at that moment. My parents weren't too thrilled with me getting kicked out of college, so I said, okay, join the military. Now, we have a family tradition, and I wanted to break it, but I also was fearful of breaking it, so I joined the Marine Corps like the rest of them, and I knew that was a mistake about the third day. I was pretty sure it was a mistake the first morning, but I gave them 3 days, and it wasn't good, and... The only thing that saved me in the Marine Corps was that I had a college background. And I had a dumb drill instructor. I know that's redundant, but I had a dumb drill instructor that couldn't pass an open book correspondence school. And he would go, give me that fat college boy up here. And I would go up and do his homework and his lessons for him. And he would give me a quart of beer. So I drank in Marine Corps boot camp. People tell me that's not possible, but they didn't have, the guy that dragged his nails, his knuckles. He was a knuckle dragger. I swear to God, he was from L.A., lower Alabama. You know how it is with Alabama. Anybody from Alabama here? I hope you're from the northern part. Okay. Because in the southern part of Georgia, we always say, do you know why the trees lean westward? And it's because Alabama sucks. And we tell Alabama jokes down there in South Georgia. We just changed Jeff Foxworthy's routine, and you're probably from Alabama. What was the last one he liked? I liked, when you see a sign that says, don't do crack, and you pull your pants up, you're probably from... Alabama. Think about it. That's probably one of the ugliest things I ever saw in a bar, is a whole line guys doing crack sitting at the bar, you know. Well, enough of this serious stuff. Let me get down to comedy. I've just failed. I failed at everything. I quit drinking. A job interview, and the guy checked my background, and he confronted me with the reality of myself. He said I was going to drink myself to death. And I just was devastated. I didn't think anybody knew. And he was quoting people that knew me. And everybody said, he's a nice guy, except he drinks. He's a nice guy, but can't follow through. You never can trust him to finish. I always come up lame in the stretch. I'd start good. I took tests good. I interviewed well. I got jobs even when I was unemployable. I didn't know it, and they didn't know it, but it took 3 or 4 weeks for people to say, he's unemployable, let's get him out of here. It was just terrible. And I had to lie all the time to myself that I was okay, that everything was okay. And I would tell these lies to myself, and toward the end, I didn't believe them. Nobody did. Nobody did. And I had to move quite a bit. I don't understand alcoholics who have lived the same place all of their life. I don't understand that. Hey, when things get rough, go. I was what we call a move-along drunk. I wasn't bad enough to put in jail all the time, and I wasn't good enough to let hang around, so some minion of the law would take me to the edge of the jurisdiction, hit me with his nightclub, and say, move along, boy. And I went to California and back twice, just moving along, you know. Take the northern route out, southern route back. And you know, you could get away with that back in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, because it looked like hippie time. I had been a beatnik, and I just floated right into being a hippie. It was real easy. Don't shave, don't bathe, wear funny clothes, put a peace sign here, make that, you know, make love, not war. Mine was a slightly different. Mine said, give war a chance. And I had long red hair. It was clear down on my shoulders. But in the morning, there was a ritual. I had to take the long red hair and bring it up. A little bald. Only blind people didn't know I was bald, you know. I could in those days I could have won comb over contest, you know. Hey, nice comb over. And then I had this leather headband to hold it in place. And it had an active verb and a pronoun right there. Just let you know where I was coming from and what I thought of you. I didn't want people really to think I was a wuss, so I had my Marine Corps medals on my tattered hippie jacket, you know. I bet that impressed people. You know, somebody stole them. Or got that one out of a pawn shop, I bet. And I just didn't fit. I just kept rolling. This guy confronted me with self. And I had a car. I had one of those alcoholic cars. Now, tomorrow or next day, you go up to the Howe Club or go down to the Triangle or go to any club, and you will see somewhere in the parking lot an alcoholic car. They lean. Because there's something broken above one wheel or another. They lean. Their tires are as bald as I am. They don't have a radio antenna. They have a straightened out clothes hanger stuck in there. And they'll lie to you. They'll go, this gets better reception than the original equipment. I designed this myself, you know. And if you get real close to them, you can see that somebody has lived in the back seat, because there's evidence. They were incontinent, which is a nice way of saying, you know. And there's mushrooms growing in the back seat, and it's moldy. Stupid joke. Do you know why amoebas fungus? Yeah, they're fun guys. Usually I work alone, but thank you. I don't come down to your place and tell you when to turn the burgers. Been waiting to use that line for years. But that's what I had. I had this alcoholic car. And I drove from Cleveland, where this job interview took place, over to Erie, and I decided I wasn't going to drink anymore. I wasn't going to do any left-handed cigarettes or anything like that anymore. I'm a real alcoholic, as described on pages 21, 22, and 23 in the Big Book. They have a tendency, real alcoholics, I don't know about the rest of you, but pure ones, but real alcoholics, according to the Big Book, are the ones that do sedatives, drink, show up at hospital emergency rooms, get a little morphine, get some more high-powered sedatives, drink again. Don't argue with me. It's in the Big Book. But that's what I am. I'm a real alcoholic. So I was in a flop house, and the commode was over in the corner, and I flushed all of my paraphernalia and all of my stuff down that commode. That commode sat there for 3 days going, yeah. Whoa. And 3 days later, I'm thinking to myself, why did I do that? I'm thinking to myself, if this is the way you live when you don't drink, I don't want to live. I knew I couldn't live drinking. I had failed at that. And now I had failed at living not drinking. And I had one out. 30 years old. I never thought I'd live to be 30, so I'm 30. And I just said, you know, this is it. And I'm going to go out and commit suicide. I'm going to get in that car, go out on the interstate. I know the bridge abutment that I want to hit. And it's going to kill me. So I'm going to mess up my face. I'll look good at the funeral. And funerals are important for me. Toward the end of my drinking, I wasn't invited to any funerals. I'd gone to one funeral, and I'm crippled. I'm badly crippled. I limp in both legs, so you don't notice too much. And I got down right near the casket, and a little clod of dirt was laying there, and I went over. I body blocked three of my relatives and myself into the hole. It's funny now. After that, they had secret funerals. I'd see some relative and I'd say, how's Aunt, you know, and they'd say, oh, she died 3 years ago. Didn't get invited to weddings either. You know how when we're drinking and you fill up those psychic holes and you're okay. Well, I'd had enough to drink that morning and I was okay. Showed up at my cousin's wedding. The minister asked that great question. Is there anybody here that knows any reason why this couple shouldn't be joined in holy matrimony? And usually, dead silence. You know, just dead silence. A couple of cough and something. Not that morning. I got up and explained why my cousin shouldn't marry that dumb SOB. No more weddings. If I'd been getting married, I wouldn't have been invited. You know, I was persona non grata at my even the low end of my family didn't have anything to do with me. The ones that were bad to drink, don't want to hang him around. If we were doing report cards, it would say does not drink well with others. Oh, didn't make it. So I'm out there. I got my car up to about 80, 85 miles an hour. It's bouncing and flopping and swinging, and I'm heading for that bridge abutment, and I ran out of gas. Once again, it's funny tonight. Very, very funny. Ho, ho, ho. But I'm sensitive. Be careful. I told my sponsor I was sensitive one time. He said, no, you're thin-skinned. And I said, well, I resent that. And he said, no, you resemble it. He didn't allow me to use the word resent. Every time I felt resentment, I had to say, oh, I resemble that. Oh. My sponsor and I had a good time. I failed at suicide. Some guy come by and give me a gallon of gas. I thought if I try it again, I'll end up with a flat tire or something, get my hands dirty. Didn't want to do that. And I went back to my alcoholic thinking, my euphemism, I'm going back to town and think about this, which meant that I was going to go to a bar and get drunk and tell the bartender what was wrong. Because they understood. And the girls in the bar, even the guys in the bar, as long as you were buying, they understood. They told you what a great guy you were. Give him another drink, yeah. How dumb. Yeah. It's just dumb. Oh, I was married once, too, while I was drinking. I took a hostage. And she escaped. She took the children and gone. I was at work one day, and a guy called me. He says, Johnny, you moving? I said, no. He says, better go home. Somebody is. Bye. Well, I like that because there were no more pablum and formula stuff in the refrigerator. It's beer now. And I didn't keep that place very long. I needed her because she had the money. And that was the beginning of my end. I just sort of wandered around. As I said, I went to California back twice, looking like a hippie, smelling like a hippie. I drank with Jack Kerouac. Oh, big deal in here. See, this is a sophisticated audience. He wrote the quintessential book about being a hippie on the road. And they even made a movie out of it. Not a very good one, but I think they were all smoking dope. That doesn't do. You can't do things when you're smoking dope. You think you can. You think you can drive fast when you're smoking dope. 18 miles an hour. There's a red light four blocks down the road. And when you're drinking with it, it's even more fun because then you have to explain to the policeman that I'm not really this drunk, I'm just high. And I thought that would get me out of it, you know. Oh, here we go. So I went back to town to get drunk. And the bar that I chose to drink in wasn't open. And I didn't have the sense to go back left, right, behind me. It was a bar town. And I remembered that several people over the years had mentioned AA. Sometimes when I was in bad trouble, why did you go to AA? Or other times, I had this wife, and she believed in subtle things. Every time I'd go to the bathroom, there'd be a different AA brochure on the hamper. And I'd have to find out exactly where it was and lift it and not break the back, you know, and read it, and then put it back like I'd never seen it. Or those Sunday supplements that always had those questionnaires. Are you an alcoholic? I took one time. Had 44 questions. I aced it. I got 42 yeses. And the one I marked no, it said, do you keep a bottle in your desk? No, it's in the file cabinet. The other one that I marked no was, does your drinking increase during your menstrual cycle? I said no. But on second thought, I thought to myself, it did during hers. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for people that work after answering services, because somebody had picked up the phone and said, hi, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Can I help you? Well, I think I might have a little problem with drinking and blah, blah, blah. And he said, where are you? And I told him a lie. I told him I was on the complete other end of town from where he was. And he said, we've got a couple guys that live out there. They can come over and see you. I said, no, no. Don't want no alcoholics come to see me. Oh, you tell me where you are, and I'll come to see you. And he told me where this place was, and the AA office was in the mission. And I thought to myself, that's where those bums hang out. Not considering what a bum I was at the moment. I guess, oh my. And my story is that I went down there, parallel parked, looked both ways, walked across the street, went inside and said, gentlemen, let's start this AA thing. Now, the people that were looking out the window told me that I jumped the curb, I knocked over a parking meter, the door popped open, I fell out, pulled myself up by the straightened out coat hanger. There was a West Virginia window involved there too. That's when windows dawn and piece of plastic with gaffer tape on it, you know. It keeps the wind out. And but anything over 35 miles an hour, it sounds like you're inside a snare drum. But, you know, it got me to where I wanted to go, I thought. And I walked in, and I was a little nervous. Hadn't had a drink for 3 days, hadn't had anything else for a week. And it was like nervous time. And I had a story all ready to tell them, but no one asked. One guy said to me, he says, would you like a cup of coffee? I don't drink coffee. I never have drank coffee. I don't drink coffee today. But I said, yeah, I didn't want to, you know, disturb their rhythm or get kicked out. I said, I'll take a cup of coffee. Styrofoam hadn't been invented yet. Big China mug with a jug-eared handle. Flippin' full of coffee. I spilled it on the ceiling. It's a beautiful absorbent acoustic steel, you know, tile ceiling. And it just sort of dripped the rest of the afternoon. They took me over and sat me down and said, we'll bring coffee to you. And they'd bring me about this much in the bottom of one of these big cups. And they'd two hands. I'd get it up there and it sounded like castanets at a flamenco dance, you know. That China mug bouncing off what teeth I had left. You ever notice that dental hygiene is not real high on the agenda of the working alcoholic? I had so many cavities I talked with an echo. But I'm, you know, I'm sober a long time now. They've come back. Somebody says, are those your teeth? I said, yes, I paid for them. Yours came with you, but mine are paid for. I was over here at the Freedom Club one night. You ever been there? It's like being out with your great-grandchildren. There are kids in there that are 12 and 14 years old who've been sober for 2 or 3 years. It's scary. And they turn the lights off and they light candles and they have a black light, and that black light makes teeth like mine fluoresce. And there's this child sitting on the end of the couch, and she says, your teeth are glowing. And I said, yes, I know. And she said, she went, big smile. She goes, are mine? I said, no, you haven't been sober long enough yet. Get a group up some night and go over to the Freedom Club. It's worth a trip. Well, you go there all the time. That's your kind of people over there. Have you ever been?
No.
He'll go. A lot of people over there your age and younger. It's scary. You know, I thought I was young when I came in AA. I was 30. But in my home group down in Hampton, we've got a little girl just turned 16 and she's getting ready to celebrate 4 years. Can you imagine being in high school and having 4 years of this program? If it was me, I would own the high school, you know, because I would be cool. She just is so wonderful. She's a beautiful child, and she thinks that what she's doing is normal, and what her classmates are doing is abnormal. I just love her. Anyhow, I walked into this back room, dingy back room of this AA place, and it looked like God's waiting room. There wasn't anybody under 50. I mean, old, burned out fools. And I'm a hippie. I'm the first one they've ever seen or smelled up close. And I, honest to God, it's God's waiting room. They were just waiting for God to go, next. And one of them would die and go on up. And I had this story, and they wouldn't ask me. They'd been sitting around all day waiting for somebody to come in that hadn't heard their story yet. They sat around and told me their story. Of course, I didn't know it at the time, but they were doing what the big book told them to do. They were reliving the horror of their past in order to help me identify and feel okay. They wanted me to identify, and so they told me what they used to be like, what happened to them, and what they were like now. And I didn't really identify so much as I compared. A guy said something, I said, is that all you ever did? Yeah. If that's all I ever did, I'd still be out there, you know. And then some guy told me something, raised my eyebrows. I thought, ooh, I've never done that, and I don't think I want to. And there was, they just told me stories, and they did it in relays, you know. Some guys, well, they were old, they all had to go home and take naps, and then the ones that had naps would be coming in. One old timer at the end of the day looked at me and he said, hey kid, do you think you're an alcoholic? Yes, sir. Do you want to do something about it? Yes, sir. Do you believe in God? Almost lost me, but I'd gone to that school, I knew, and I said, yes, I believe there is a God. He got a big beatific smile on his face and he said, oh, that's wonderful. Those are the first three steps. We'll start on your inventory tomorrow morning. I've always been good at taking tests, and I thought, well, this is no different. I've aced the first three steps. I don't know how many there are, but this is good. And they took me out and kept me busy until time for the meeting, and I went to the meeting with them that night. I'm still a little nervous, still a little bit limpy, and it was in the basement, and I fell down the steps, sort of rolled into the meeting room, and the chairperson goes, oh, we have a new guy. And I didn't know how he knew. But, you know, and they made me suck in some more coffee, and some guy talked, and I don't remember what he said. All I remembered was that everything was better for him. Everything was better for him. And everybody clapped for him and blah, 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 and it was over. And I thought, well, now I want, and they said, come on. Oh, let me remind myself of one thing we did at the beginning of that AA meeting. The man that had come up and said, I'm your sponsor, tried to break his elbow on my ribs. Come on. Oh. And we went up front, and they gave me the big book, opened to the third step prayer. And my sponsor and I got down on our knees by the podium, and he said it from memory, and I read it in front of the group. They qualified me. These old timers would say things like, kid, are you really ready to quit drinking for the rest of your life? Do you really mean what you say here? Do you really want what we have? Well, I wasn't sure I wanted what they had, but well, this one guy had a nice car, and you should have seen the girlfriend that I wanted. Everybody was sharing experience, strength, and hope. No girlfriends, no cars. You know, okay. Cheap. I got a job the next day. I had been unemployable for months, years. And somebody came up and said, John, didn't you used to 10 bar for my brother when you were in college? I said, yeah. He says, good, I need a bartender. I had a job. I was a bartender. All I had to do was get up in the morning, open the bar at 7 o'clock, work it till 10 in the morning, somebody would relieve me, and then I would come back at 10 that night and close. And I got a free room and board, basically what I could steal from the cash register, and AA didn't make that big of an impression on my character defects at the beginning. I did that for 5 months. Sponsor said to me one day, what do you do? for a living. And I told him. Sponsor finger went up in the air. Don't, you can't do that. Look like Al-Anon. Don't do that. I said, but, and I explained to him about not being able to talk. AA was wonderful. They told me to shut up for the first year. You didn't talk in AA. There were no discussion meetings where the first day you're still sweating yesterday's beer, where the chairman goes, would you like to say something? Give me a break. What's a newcomer know? How to get drunk? How to steal? We know how to do that. They need to shut up and listen to us because we can tell them how to not drink, how to not steal, how to not do stupid things. You know, shut up and listen for a year. Don't get involved in being a wonderful, oh, thank you for sharing. Oh, give me a break. I don't want sharing. I want experience, strength, and hope. I don't want your feelings. I want your experience, strength, and hope. There's a soapbox up here, and I'm on it right now. I'm sorry. That's AA. AA is not touchy-feely. AA is not share how you feel. My sponsor didn't care how I felt. He said to me one night, you know, I got this job, Tenon Bar, didn't have to start till the next day, so I went down to meet with the Jolly Boys, and we started on my inventory. What's the worst thing you ever did? You think I'm going to tell you that? You're crazy. Statute of limitation isn't out on some of that stuff yet. The capital crimes, it's still out there. I finally found something I could tell them. They told me a couple stories. We told stories back and forth. It was the worst fourth and fifth step I've ever done. But it was wonderful because it blunted the edge of my desire to drink. I didn't want to drink that day. I felt better. Had to keep going back every day and re-upping it because, and they didn't tell me anything like 90 meetings in 90 days. They said, try our way of life for 3 months, and if you don't like it, we will refund every bit of misery and stupidity that you ever had, plus more. And they told me that they had ruined my drinking by showing me the other side. I believe it. Incidentally, I didn't mention this, but on May 1st, 1968, if they had been giving out white chips, I would still only have one. And it's not, you know, the only reason I'm saying that is because there might be somebody new here tonight who thinks, because of what they heard, that it's okay to relapse. Relapse is part of the disease. Well, yeah, it's part of the disease. It's not part of recovery. You don't have to go out and drink again. My sponsor said to me when I asked about relapse, he says, don't take it. He said, find somebody that's just gone out and go see what they did. Ask them how it was. I've never had anybody tell me how great it was. Or they wouldn't have come back. So we did this fourth and fifth step. We kept chopping at it and everything like that. I'm out of time. Not even there yet. I came a long way. I'm an out-of-town speaker. Give me a couple minutes. The one thing at that time that was very, very important to me was my sponsor took me 105 miles to Cleveland to hear a man speak. The man's name was Alan Gallagher. He's from Eatontown, New Jersey. And he finished his talk by saying, I submit to you that it is easier to act yourself into proper thinking than to think yourself into proper acting. Elbow into my rib. Oh, did you get that? Yes, I did. But this went on all the way home. And we didn't take the interstate back. We took the scenic route along the lake at midnight. So we could talk about what Mr. Gallagher had said. The only thing good about going to an out-of-town meeting was I didn't have to wash the dishes after the meeting. They looked at how shaky I was at the first meeting. They said, you can wash the spoons. You know, a couple months later, they brought a guy in and said, he's going to wash the spoons. And I got upset. That's my job. They moved me up to forks, buddy. I wasn't up to knives yet, but I was up to forks. They put us to work right away. Right away. And they stood around the kitchen and told anecdotes. And we had to listen to them. There was a meeting before AA, and there was a meeting after AA. Just like tonight, I made a wonderful lead on the way up here. I mean, really superb. And I'm going to do a good one on the way home. I don't know what we're going to have here, except overtime. If you're done listening before I'm done talking, remember I'm sensitive. Try to look like you're going somewhere, or you're sick, or you know, get two people to drag you out like you're in a heart attack. Whatever. I didn't really mean that, but remember I'm sensitive. But, you know, that in essence is the sixth and seventh step. You act differently in order to stop doing what your mind tells you to do. Your mind's a dangerous place. When you're just getting sober, there's all kinds of weird ideas in there. To think back. Think of some of the things you thought about doing. Some of you even thought about rewriting the big book and fixing it, because it had mistakes in it, you know. There's some grammar that needed straightened up and syntax, and Bill was into yellow journalism, stuff like that, you know. Incidentally, I might be the only person in the room that ever sat at a kitchen table and drank coffee with Bill Wilson. And I look back on it now as just one of those awesome moments. But the night it was happening, I was sitting there fidgeting because I wanted to go back to the dance. My priorities weren't all that great when I was brand new in AA. And I did this eighth and ninth step thing, you know, and God, those are easy. Have you figured out how easy it is to do an eighth step? Pay the money back. No one ever refused the money. I mean, I went up to one guy and I gave him money I owed him for years, 12, 15 years. And he goes, he counts it, and he goes, wow, that's great. I'm walking out the door. He says, hey, John, your credit's good with me anytime. And I said, Mr. Black, I've skinned you for this money for 12, 15 years. He says, yeah, but you paid it back. He pulled the drawer open. He said, now these guys haven't. You get them in AA, and you've done something, you know. And you know what Mr. Black did from then on? Anytime he had an employee, a neighbor, a friend, or anything that had a drug or alcohol problem, he would call me and he'd say, Mr. Cornelius, can you come up to the store? We made a believer out of him. I was the only copy of the big book he'd ever seen. And we made a believer out of him. Some of those eighth and ninth steps don't have money involved. Some of them you have to call the person up and really and truly say to them, I was wrong. I treated you badly. I made a mistake. And for God's sakes, don't tell anybody you're sorry. In my case, they knew I was a sorry SOB. I didn't have to tell them I was sorry. They knew what they wanted to hear, what every one of your loved ones and family and the former employers, what they all want to hear is, I was wrong. I made a mistake. What can I do to make it right? I said that to Mac's wife. You might know her. She's a very famous person. She's a test pilot for a broom factory. I knew you'd get it. Halloween isn't that far behind us, you know. She said, why don't you die? And then she said, no, I don't want that. Just stay away. Do what the court order said. Stay away. I went to my sponsor. No. She won't let me be a father. I want to be a father. He goes, sounds like a bright woman. He says, you've never been a father. You wouldn't know how. You were a sperm donor. You know, that's all that. Anybody could have done that. And you know, oh, I want to be a father. He said, good. And we went down to Big Brothers and I signed up. He said, because there are kids down there that even you can be a father image to. So I'm down there at Big Brothers. And kids are sharp. And as a professional in this field of kids, I know they're sharp. They see through. I don't lie to kids. Kids ask me, are you the real Santa Claus? I go, can't tell you. You have to figure it out yourself. I won't tell you. Some of them go, yeah, you are. Some go, ah, you're not. And it's okay. But I learned how to be a father. We're at an AA meeting one time, and a woman's there with a little baby, and the baby's acting up. My sponsor, go get the kid. Take it outside and play. I said, why? Because if you don't, she's going to get up and leave, and she needs the meeting. Well, I need the meeting too. Not as bad as she does. Get the kid and go outside and play. This is, you want to feel dumb, go over to some woman and say, excuse me, ma'am, I'd like to take a child outside and play. And honest to God, she just went, thank you. And the kid and I went out and played. And this happened more and more. It came to the place where I was carrying candy and toys in the car. Kids are not dumb. They'd see me coming in, they'd go, see the guy with the red beard? Let's act up. He's got candy and games and toys. And we can go outside. It's raining. Don't care. We run outside and play. They taught me. That's one thing about AA. If you're a willing pupil, you'll learn. You'll learn the life gains and the life results and the rules and the variations and the exceptions. You'll learn them here. 10th step. What's it say? It says continue. Continue what? 4th and 5th. If you're doing the same 10th step to the same person under the same circumstances over and over and over again, does not that indicate to you that perhaps you have a character defect? And not only do you have a character defect, you're acting on it. Your shortcomings are showing. So the 10th step lets us circle this and keep circling and picking up the trash and the wreckage and the debris. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation. Prayer is when I talk to God. Meditation is when I listen. I do not hang out where burning bushes occur. No rent in the sky has ever left. John, here's what I want you to do. No. Meditation for me is to tell my group, my sponsor, my spiritual advisor, my minister, somebody I've picked up hitchhiking, and tell them what I've been praying about. And then shut up and listen. And I've learned too not to judge the message by the messenger, but to just accept the message. Sometimes the messenger is pukey, you know, and you think to yourself, what can he tell me? He can tell me how to save my life today. Thank you. Thank you. 12th step. You have that spiritual awakening. We talk about God consciousness almost from the very instant we come in here. But the real spiritual awakening happens after the 11th step. That's what it says. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We try to carry this message to others. We try to share this. And then comes the worst part of this whole program, because it's like a curse. Especially if you're not really wanting to be here. But if you really want to be here, it's not a curse, it's a guideline. And to practice these principles in all our affairs. Yeah, practice. What are the principles? I don't know. We started off with absolute purity, absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. That's what they started AA with. The four absolutes of the Oxford group, the 6 steps of the Oxford group. We're just a variation on the theme. I believe that the principle we work under best is love. Love, the absolute, unconditional, compassionate concern for another human being without thought, hope, or expectation. Remember I told you that my wife insisted that I never see her or the family ever again. And I wanted to, but I didn't, because I made an agreement. And I made that agreement in 1967, the year before I got sober. And the year I was 28 years sober, 1996, through a series of beautiful, godlike coincidences, I was given the Santa Claus job at the mall in the little town that Alan Gallagher from Eatontown, New Jersey was from. Mr. Gallagher, the one that told me how to do steps 6 and 7. He'd gone to the big meeting, but I went to where he lived because I remembered him. And the first Sunday that I was on the Santa chair, and I only had to work till 6 o'clock on Sundays, because they closed the mall. And I was scheduled to lead the New York Metropolitan Old Timers meeting that night. And this woman came up and sat on my lap. And I said, "What's your name?" And she said, "You know what my name is, Daddy." And this was my daughter, and I hadn't seen her for 29 years. She lived less than 4 miles from the mall. Mr. Gallagher and I didn't know that. My sponsor didn't know that, but God knew. God started a thread in Cleveland, Ohio, with this man from New Jersey and me from Pennsylvania, and my sponsor egging me on. And it came to a rope and a cable when that woman said to me, "I'm your daughter, and I wanted to know what you looked like and what you're like." She'd been told I was an SOB. Pretty astute and everything like that. I said, "But I'm not now. I'm not an SOB anymore. I'm sober." And my sponsor told me that you would come someday, that I'd better be sober, and I better be doing something good. And she had watched me for over an hour before she came to me. And she saw me interacting with kids, people that you can't fool. And it was wonderful. I spoke at that meeting that night, and there were people in the front row that had over 50 years of sobriety. And none of us had a dry eye. And one old timer came up to me and he said, "See, it works. It really works." My whole life for the last 36 and a half years has been dedicated, sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes just mediocre, and sometimes just excellent, to making sure that when the hand reaches out for help, that I will be responsible enough to be there. That I will be of service to my fellow drunks. That I will be of service to the person who just desperately needs help the way I did. When I was brand new in AA, I was introduced to reading the big book. I read the big book on a regular occasion. May I have the use of that one? I'm an actor, and I memorize lines, but I made it a point never to memorize these lines, because they're too important. And I could change them, and I don't want to do that. But on page 89 in this book, under the second paragraph of the chapter 7, Working with Others, it says, "Life will take on new meaning to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish. Let me repeat that. To watch loneliness vanish. God, do you remember how lonely you were? How we alcoholics feel the pain of loneliness. Other people don't. To see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. You've been a bright spot in my life tonight. Thank you very much, and I love you.